From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, what is the state of the 61-year-old Enbridge oil pipeline under the Straits of Mackinac?
Enbridge argues that these pipes, if properly maintained, will last forever. Well, we aren't quite believers that that's the case.
Is enough being done to prevent another electric crisis in Michigan?
It takes quite a while to change the corporate culture, and it takes a while to restore public trust in the organization.
A Michigan poet spends some 40 years translating the powerful words of Peruvian poet Cesar Vallejo.
When you take on one of these big projects, you learn things about yourself and about your commitment to the art and what poetry can be.
Those stories and much more today on Stateside. It's been a year since a powerful winter storm left thousands and thousands without power in Lansing. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today on Stateside, is enough being done to prevent another electric crisis in Michigan? But first, the oil spill disaster on the Kalamazoo River got a lot of people in Michigan wondering, what is the state of Michigan's oil and gas pipelines? In particular, what about that 61-year-old Enbridge oil pipeline that crosses the Straits of Mackinac? Any break in that pipeline would be sheer catastrophe for the Great Lakes. Ken Winter and Jim Hill have an idea they think could protect the Straits from oil spills, not with more state regulations, but with what they call a market-based approach. Ken Winter teaches at North Central Michigan College, and he's the former editor and publisher of the Petoskey News Review. Hello, Ken.
How are you, Cindy?
Good to have you back on the program. And Jim Hill is a former Michigan Natural Resources Commissioner who now teaches at Central Michigan University. Welcome to the program, Jim.
Thank you, Cindy.
You two collaborated on a guest commentary for Bridge Magazine calling for a new way to what, keep Enbridge on its corporate toes, Ken?
The idea here is that I had a public policy class and we were trying to come up with a thought of how to avoid the politics and get into actually dealing with a concern we had, and that was who financially pays for any damages that may occur down the road with the pipeline.
Jim, what would this policy do?
Well, you know, there's four routes to go. Three routes that have been mentioned, and ours is the fourth. Enbridge argues that these pipes, if properly maintained, will last forever. Well, we aren't quite believers that that's the case. The environmentalists want the pipeline to go through the Great Lakes Submerged Lands Act and get a permit, and they think that will probably stop it, which it might. But that's court litigation and the fact that that Enbridge got their pipeline in before the Great Lakes Submerged Act was passed. The state's got a task force out there to do inspections and emergency preparation, but it's basically a after-the-fact situation. What we're suggesting is, you know what, if the shareholders of Enbridge got a taste of the true cost of a catastrophic spill in the Straits of Mackinac, recognizing that it's going to be exponentially greater than the Kalamazoo spill if the amount of oil is spilled is the same, about 1 million gallons, that they might want to think twice about continuing that pipeline, that its profitability may not be real, and that with real numbers out there, they may decide that either they have to make some major changes in the pipeline or maybe even withdraw the pipeline altogether.
Is there any idea what that cost might be? I know we were looking at about $1 billion for the Kalamazoo River cleanup. Have you crunched any kind of numbers that you think would impress those shareholders?
Well, that's an area that we're still working on. In fact, we're thinking that maybe it might be smarter to ask the state to find some economists or researchers that could answer that question in an impartial way and provide that data, because we're afraid that if we asked anybody ourselves that they may not be viewed as impartial.
And if I could add, the University of Michigan did a simulation of what a 1 million gallon spill would be, like the one in Kalamazoo, which is online and you can view. And I mean, it covers Mackinac Island, it goes as far west as Beaver Island. I mean, it is a huge spill. So If it costs $1 billion to clean up a spill on a river inland, you got to think that the cost of cleaning up the same amount of oil in the Great Lakes would just be, considerably higher.
Can you give us a sense of what's currently in place to regulate or keep an eye on Enbridge and its pipelines?
Well, the pipeline itself is regulated by the federal government, because it crosses interstate lines. But the pipeline lies on the bottom lands, which the state of Michigan gave an easement to Enbridge to run. So actually there's two areas of responsibility. There's the federal government, which is supposed to regulate the safety of the pipeline, but there's the state of Michigan that has control over where the where these pipeline is laying on the Straits of Mackinac. So there are the problem is, I think the state thinks, well, this is really a federal issue. But I think many in the environmental community and others think, no, this is equally a state issue because they're on the public trust land.
Until recently, I learned that the state kept referring all questions to the federal government, and now because of the new awareness of the pipeline, because of Marshall, people are now trying to ask the governor to take advantage of the authority that we have and start becoming more involved in the actual pipeline.
As you say in your joint commentary, Enbridge, instead of further regulating the potential polluter, in this case Enbridge, Enbridge instead would sign an agreement with the state that they would be solely and strictly liable for any spill caused by their pipeline. So as you say, let them back their words with their corporate checkbook. So here's my question. Let's say the state and Enbridge did this, shook hands on this market-driven agreement, and then that Line 5 pipeline cracks, you have that catastrophic spill into the Straits, an environmental catastrophe. What keeps Enbridge from declaring bankruptcy and going out of business and then returning under a new name?
Well, that's exactly the beauty of what we're trying to propose, and that is that we just read recently that the Enbridge president had said that they really didn't want to insure for more than $700 million because they didn't think it was worth it. And our concern is that if we don't have something like this in a trust fund ahead of time, that they could exactly do that or do something else. And this takes the politics out of it because the money will already be in place and they'll continue under our proposal to contribute to that fund every year.
The reason why the BP spill was such a difficult one was because there were multiple parties involved. If Enbridge realizes from the start that they are going to be, regardless of what happens, weather, terrorism, doesn't matter what, if that line explodes, they're going to be solely liable for paying for it. We think that that's going to make Enbridge much more focused on making sure that pipeline is safe. And if they feel it is not safe, then they may very well just say, you know what, it's not worth it. We're going to shut it down on our own. And that way it's not the state having to oversee it or the state telling them to do it. It's Enbridge saying, now we're seeing the real costs and our real responsibility. We recognize this isn't where we want to be in our corporate life, and maybe we need to do another thing, and that might very well be to withdraw Line 5 or at least go down and double hull it or do something that will maintain and protect it because they realize the life of their corporation is at stake.
The line is already in place. It would certainly be understandable if they were looking to build this line, but here it is. It's been in place for 61 years. Why would Enbridge say, sure, I'll sign on this? Where's the coercion factor?
Two things. One, the easement that they signed says that they will be responsible for any spills that take place. And I think what they're really concerned about, I'm only speculating, I think they're really concerned about making major changes because they feel that if they do, they'll have to go through a permit process that might very well make the pipeline or at least delay the pipeline for some time. So I think what we see in this instance is, look, the state is not going to impose more regulations upon you, even though they have the power under the easement to do so. Instead, what we're simply going to say is, let's decide what the cost of a truly catastrophic spill, not a small spill. I mean, Enbridge has been arguing that the worst-case scenario is 8 minutes to respond. Well, it's almost a four-mile pipeline, and they have 23 million gallons of petroleum products going through it every day. It still would be a significant spill even if they shut it off, but they have to say, well, you know what? We've agreed initially in the easement that we'd do this, and now times have changed, and now with all this pressure, we're going to have to show that we're willing to take the risk. And if they're not, if Enbridge says, no, we're not willing to take that risk, then people should say, well, then why not? If you're convinced that this is not going to be a problem, then why won't you say, if you say the risk is so remote, why won't you take that responsibility? And I think that's when the state and the public should say, if you're not willing to stand up by this, then maybe we need to take a more deliberative action.
Do you see the task force that's headed by Attorney General Bill Schuette and then DEQ Director Dan Wyant, would they be the ones to approach Enbridge with this or try to implement that? Who should do it?
Well, actually, it's interesting you mention it because Jim and I were talking yesterday. You know, there's not a lot of public transparency in those meetings. I've had different friends appear before the group, and we're actually now thinking that maybe we should make an effort to present our proposal to the group, because it's something completely different than a lot of the other special interest groups and people have been talking to them about.
But I agree with you, Cindy, and I think with you too, Ken. I think that they have to be the initial point, but really this is something that the state of Michigan needs to say, and I'd say it really has to come from the governor's office, quite frankly. I think the governor's got to step in and say, you know what, this is our greatest resource, and we've got to have an assurance more than just, you know, it's not going to happen or it's a remote possibility, because we already saw it happen in 2010. So, it's time for us to take a statewide action, and that would be either you guys agree to take full responsibility or we have to take measures to make sure we protect our greatest resource.
Ken Witter and Jim Hill, you can dive in to their guest commentary. Market-based approach will best protect the Straits from spills by going to bridgemi.com. Thank you so much, Ken and Jim, for talking with us today on Stateside.
You're welcome, Cindy.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. We live, it's safe to say, in an era of instant gratification. Whatever it is, we want fast results. We want it done now. But there are those who are willing to take whatever time it takes to accomplish something they believe is worth doing and doing right. My next guest is one such person. Clayton Eshelman is a professor emeritus in the English department at Eastern Michigan University. He's a poet. He's a translator. Clayton Eshelman spent decades translating the works of renowned Peruvian poet Cesar Vallejo. It has become a book that's entitled The Complete Poetry, Cesar Vallejo, a translation that's earned him awards. So, Clayton Eshelman, very good to have you with us today.
Thank you.
How many years did it take? I'm holding this hefty 676-page translation of Vallejo's poetry.
Well, I discovered Vallejo when I was a student at Indiana University and had just started writing poetry in 1957. I discovered Vallejo and Pablo Neruda in an anthology, and that moved me to hitchhike 2 summers to go to Mexico and start to learn Spanish. And then I moved to Japan for several years and took a collection of Vallejo's poems with me to Japan with me. And once there, I began to try to figure out what I was going to do with my life as a poet. I mean, it's one thing to write poems when you're in college. It's something else when you get out.
And there are bills to pay.
And I was teaching English as a second language to Japanese executives at the time. So I had a friend named Will Peterson, and he came over to visit me one day, and I said, where have you been? He said, I just met a very interesting man. He says, he's a bonsai gardener. He says, he just finished his apprenticeship. And I said, well, how old is he? And he says, well, he's in his early 60s. And that really took me, because I'd never thought about apprenticeship before. And here I was facing the fact that in another society, why, you apprentice yourself most of your life to the art or the discipline, and then had a chance after that to do something on your own. So I started thinking about apprenticeship, and I took out the Vallejo poetry one day and started reading it. It was very complex and beyond my Spanish at the time. At one point, I read a poem of Vallejo's from the Human Poems, which was written in Paris in the 1930s, and I read a poem that just made my hair stand on end. And I'm thinking maybe it would be appropriate to read that poem now, because it was the piece that really got me involved in Vallejo.
All right, go ahead.
It's untitled. There are days there comes to me an exuberant political hunger to desire, to kiss tenderness on both cheeks. And there comes to me from afar a demonstrative desire, another desire to love, willingly or by force, whoever hates me, whoever tears up his paper, the little boy, the woman who weeps for the man who was weeping, the king of wine, the slave of water, whoever hid in his wrath, whoever sweats, whoever passes by, whoever shakes his person in my soul. And I desire, therefore, to adjust the braid of whoever talks to me, the soldier's hair, the light of the great, the greatness of the child. I desire to iron directly a handkerchief for whoever is unable to cry, and when I'm sad or happiness aches me, to mend the children and the geniuses. I desire to help the good one become a little bad, and I have an urge to be seated to the right of the left-handed and to respond to the mute, trying to be useful to him as I can. And likewise, I desire very much to wash the cripple's foot and to help my one-eyed neighbor sleep. Ah, to desire this one, mine, this one, the world's, interhuman and parochial, mature. It comes perfectly timed from the foundation, from the public groin, and coming from afar makes me hunger to kiss the singer's muffler, and whoever suffers, to kiss him on his frying pan, the deaf man fearlessly on his cranial murmur, whoever gives me what I forgot in my breast, on his Dante, on his chaplain, on his shoulders. I desire, finally, when I'm at the celebrated edge of violence or my heart full of chest, I would desire to help whoever smiles laugh, to put a little bird right on the evildoer's nape, to take care of the sick, annoying them, to buy from the vendor, to help the killer kill. A terrible thing. And I would desire to be good to myself in everything.
That is Clayton Eshelman, who spent how many years, Clayton? That poem launched you into...
yes, it ended in 2007 when University of California Press published the complete poetry. But there were many stages in the in the production.
But in overall, you spent literally some 45 years working on this translation of the complete poetry.
From time to time.
Yes. not nonstop, but
not nonstop,
working to bring the poems of Cesar Vallejo to audiences in America.
Right.
First of all, tell us who this man was.
Well, he was a Peruvian born in a small mountain village called Santiago de Chuco in northern Peru, parallel to Trujillo.
And in the late 19th
in
century.
In 1892. And he studied philosophy at the University of Trujillo and moved to Lima. He got involved in a situation where a store was burned and someone was murdered in his hometown. And he was associated with the evildoers, and so he spent 3 months in jail at one point. And while he was in jail, he began to work on the poems that ultimately became Trilce, which is his second collection, published in 1923, and which is one of the strangest and most groundbreaking books of poetry published this century. Mm-hmm. After he got out of jail, he found out that he was going to be indicted and he might go to prison. So he accepted a third-class boat ticket to Europe and moved to France and never returned to Peru. He lived until 1938, mainly in Paris. He was extremely poor, homeless at times. He met a woman who had a little money, and she meagerly supported him for a while. At one point, he made a trip to Russia, and he wrote a couple of travel books on Russia. He became a communist in 1928. He spent time in Spain during the Spanish Civil War, and his last collection, the fourth collection of poems, is called España, parte de mí esta cáliz, Spain, take this cup from me, in which he takes the words of Christ to the Father and places Mother Spain in the place of the Father. He returned to Paris and died from no particular explanation.
But a terribly hard life.
Yeah.
In 1938 he died.
Yeah. So he was 46 years old.
What do you think that this man, born in the Peruvian Andes over 120 years ago, says to readers in Michigan in 2014?
I think the key lesson that he holds today may be that a poet must learn how to become imprisoned in global life as a whole and in each moment in particular, to believe that his bewildering situation and his destiny are significant, and to try to, as it were, engage not only the personal life, but a political life as it infects him. In other words, it's an attempt to deal as thoroughly as possible with the contradictions and the irresolutions in the world and to stay with it and to believe that your bewildering situation is significant.
When you were inspired by that poem that you just read to us of Vallejo's, did you realize you were embarking on something that would be more than four decades long to be able to translate these poems? You were even saying it was beyond your Spanish. So you had to teach yourself more Spanish?
I had to teach myself more Spanish. And I also, at various stages in this saga, I worked with scholars because my Spanish has never become good enough to completely on my own deal with someone as complex as Vallejo. Mm. At the beginning, I was working on his finest collection of poems called the Poemas Humanos, the human poems, which were written in Europe. And my first sense was that I would take on my apprenticeship by translating the 89 poems in the human poems. So I did 9 drafts, and Grove Press brought out a translation of the human poems in 1968. I moved to Los Angeles. I was part of the faculty of the California College of the Arts in 1970. And I met a man named Jose Rubia Barcia, who was a poet and a translator and a scholar who was at UCLA. And at that point, I had not done the Spanish poems, and so I asked Barcia if he would like to go over the Spanish texts with me. We worked together so well that I tremblingly showed him my human poems translation and ask him what he thought of it. And he said, well, it's not bad. He said, but it can be much better. So almost every evening after dinner for the next 5 years, I went over to Barcia's house and we worked several hours on going over my translation of the human poems. So University of California Press then brought out that collection called The Complete Posthumous Poetry in 1978 and it received the National Book Award.
Yes, it did.
I thought my work was over at that point, but then I began to nag myself over Trilce, because Trilce was the real mountain with Vallejo. So to make the long saga a bit shorter, I worked on Trilce in the late 80s, and one version was published in 1989. A second version was published in the early 1990s by Wesleyan University Press, and then a third version was published when I brought out the complete poetry in 2007.
And here it is. Yeah. What surprised you about yourself and about Vallejo as you took such a deep, deep dive as you translated his works?
I was surprised that I had the stamina to do this. I went to Peru in 1965. At that point, I had a seventh draft, and I went to Peru because his widow, Georgette, a French woman who he married in the early 30s, was living, thanks to the Peruvian government, quite well in Lima, Peru. And she had the worksheets for the human poems, which had never been completed in Vallejo's life. He died before he could complete the book, and he left a typed manuscript with many penciled corrections on it. She read the penciled corrections and created a text and a book. And then she began to quarrel with everyone, and various versions of the human poems started coming out, all with many errors because she would not allow anyone to have contact with the worksheets. She had a terrible hate and love relationship with him. So I thought, well, the only way I'm going to get to the bottom of this thing is if I go to Lima and get her to show me the worksheets so I can work off of the worksheets rather than these erroneous texts.
And by this point, you had some credibility.
Well, I also had a pregnant wife and $300. And off we went. And I got down to Lima, and once I made contact with her, she told me that the worksheets were not available, and she didn't really want to have anything to do with my work. So there I was, sort of stuck in Lima with a pregnant wife and not knowing what to do with myself.
By the way, we should say your wife's an angel.
So I found someone to work with in Lima, a woman named Maureen Ahern, who was a scholar of Peruvian literature. Came back, and after I got back, I moved to New York, and I completed a 9th draft. At that point, the problem was to get Georgette's permission, because Grove Press was convinced that if they published my translation without her permission, she could sue them. So that's another story which I go into in the translation memoir. But somehow we tricked her into signing a contract. And so that's how the first human poems came out in 1968.
Tell me what lessons you believe that we could all learn, not even so much from the actual poems of Vallejo, but your undertaking and your diligence and your stick-to-itiveness over these decades.
Well, I think it's very important for artists to take on big saturation jobs, one or two at least, in their lifetime. I think you learn something from a big, long project in which you try to corner or to encompass everything about one particular subject. When you take on one of these big projects that are really involve a terrific saturation, you learn things about yourself and about your commitment to the art and what poetry can be that you don't by simply working on single individual poems.
Would you close by sharing another favorite poem of Vallejo's with us?
Yeah. This is another one from the Human Poems. Though maybe since I read one from the Human Poems, I should read one from Trilce. To give the listeners a sense of a different aspect of Vallejo. This is Trilce number 36. There are 77 poems in Trilce, and they're just numbered. Many are not titled. This was published before he left Peru in 1923. We struggle to thread ourselves through a needle's eye, face to face, hell-bent on winning. The fourth angle of the circle ammoniifies, almost. Female is continued the male on the basis of probable breasts and precisely on the basis of how much does not flower. Are you that way, Venus de Milo? You hardly act crippled, pullulating and wombed in the plenary arms of existence, of this existence that nevertheless is perpetual imperfection. Venus de Milo, whose cut-off increate arm swings round and tries to elbow across greening, stuttering pebbles. Ortive nautili, recently crawling evens, immortal on the eaves of. Lassoer of eminences, lassoer of the parenthesis. Refuse, all of you, to set foot on the double security of harmony. Truly refuse symmetry. Intervene in the conflict of points that contend in the most rutty of jousts for the leap through the needle's eye. So now I feel my little finger in excess on my left. I see it and think, it shouldn't be me, or at least that it's in a place where it shouldn't be. And it inspires me with rage and alarms me, and there is no way out of it except by imagining that today is Thursday. Make way for the new odd number, potent with orphanhood.
That is the poetry of Cesar Vallejo, considered to be one of the greatest poets of the 20th century in any language, being read by Clayton Eshelman, my guest, who's editor and translator of the complete poetry, Cesar Vallejo. He's also professor emeritus of English at Eastern Michigan University. Professor, thank you so much for sharing your love of
this
man's
welcome.
Poetry with us.
Thank you.
And we always want to hear from you. What issues do you want to hear more about in 2015 or people you want us to profile? Let us know. We're on Twitter at Stateside Radio. We're on Facebook. Just search for Stateside with Cynthia Canty. And at MichiganRadio.org. So click the link that says Stateside. While you're there, you can catch up on stories and interviews that you might have missed. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. It has been a year since a monster ice storm knocked out the power for some 40,000 Lansing Board of Water and Light customers. Thousands of people had to spend Christmas and New Year's in the dark as BWL crews struggled to restore power. Some people didn't get their electricity restored for more than 10 days. The public was outraged, especially after learning BWL's general manager took a Christmas vacation to New York while so many customers were without power. And boy, they didn't miss the chance to vent.
Hi. First off, midnight tonight, I will have been without power for 10 days. I still have no power. There is a lack of communication. There is a lack of information.
Heaven forbid that people die. I had several elderly people, they're calling me saying, Simone, when are we going to get our power back on? I don't know. We can't get through. There's no answers.
If I treated my dog the way y'all treated us, I'd be in jail. All of you need to be charged with reckless endangerment. You left us out to die.
I don't even think people would be this upset if they thought that somebody cared. Did nobody care?
There is no acceptable excuse. This is not some remote village in the Appalachians. It's the capital city of this state.
So will things be different this winter in Lansing? My next guest was part of the community review team that released a 75-page report looking into the way BWL handled this crisis. Michael McDaniel is with us now. He's a professor at Western Michigan University's Cooley Law School in Lansing. He's also a retired brigadier general. Good to have you with us.
Thank you, Cynthia. It's nice to be on your show.
Well, certainly, Michael, Mother Nature hit, you know, with a really hard blow. But what did your report find that BWL did or did not do that made things worse?
Well, there was a confluence of a number of events, but the failure to fulfill their tree trimming program over the last 5 to 10 years, the inability of its outage management system to work correctly, the inability to move out with spotters to go check for downlines immediately, all three of those sort of came together to create sort of a perfect storm along with Mother Nature, as you said, and caused the actual outage itself to be more widespread and to last longer than we believe it should have.
So let's talk about the outage management system that you found was defective. What is that? What was wrong? And do you think it's been fixed for this winter?
The system had been in the sort of beta testing for about 2 years, and it was not ready to be used. It was one of those instances where there was no redundancy. They didn't keep a previous system in place while this system was being ramped up for full use. So when that system failed, they had to sort of fall back on taking in calls and making handwritten notes and then sort of creating an Excel spreadsheet. And you can just see sort of the inherent difficulties you're going to have with accuracy and redundancy within that sort of paper system and being able to keep that up to speed. The outage management system was a way in which you could tell exactly where every downed line was by using, you know, sort of a computerized system, which Consumers Power and DTE already use. And then, of course, you would have had the ability to put the results of that system on your website so that those customers who were able to go to a place where there was power could then pull it up and see that it was working. That system has been implemented. It has been tested. There have been assurances that the system will now work. It was just one of those things where they were trying to get the system in place and it wasn't there in a proper amount of time. Between that system and they are now doing a rollout with the idea of smart meters, you'll be able to have a much more accurate assessment of where you have down power lines or which customers are lacking service.
Now over to tree trimming that was a problem. And my understanding is now there are people complaining that perhaps BWL has been, you know, gone overboard in the tree trimming. Where does that stand?
Yeah, there's a certain irony there, perhaps, because some of the individuals in the same neighborhood that were the most vocal about the lack of power are the individuals that are complaining that BWL is being too aggressive with their tree trimming. Bottom line is that the Board of Water and Light is only trimming trees or having a contracted service trim trees within the utility right-of-way. They've certainly got the legal authority to do so. We, the community review team, criticize that they had not done that, and now they're getting pushback from some of the same neighbors that they are overly aggressive in trimming trees.
You can't have it both ways.
Right, exactly.
The optics of BWL's general manager, Peter Lark, going off for that Christmas getaway to New York in the middle of this emergency, not very good, but he was reappointed GM earlier this year. Do you think Peter Lark has won back any measure of public trust?
Well, I think he's starting to. First, in our report, we looked at that issue in the public hearing that we held where we specifically asked him about that, and we were not able to tie any lack of response to his being out of state. He was in full communication. And everyone in the BWL was going forward with their response efforts and their restoration of power efforts. So, as you say, the optics certainly looked bad, but we were not able to find that it had any measurable effect on their response and restoration efforts.
So did the team have any problem with him being reappointed in light of the debacle?
No. I mean, it was our job, it was our duty to simply make recommendations in all the areas that we did. And we did that with, you know, some 50 recommendations over 75 pages, and we were pretty candid in our report. And then it was up to the actual appointed board. It's an 8-member board appointed by the Lansing mayor to make the decision whether or not to reappoint him.
Now, one of your team's recommendations has been put into place, and that is appoint one person to be the person in charge, the point guy for future emergencies, and BWL is chosen Lansing's Assistant Fire Chief Trent Atkins as the new Emergency Operations Manager. Your thoughts on that choice?
I think it was a great choice. Trent Atkins is a 25-year veteran of Lansing Fire Department. I first met him when I was the State Homeland Security Advisor, and he had just been appointed as the Emergency Manager for the City of Lansing. There was some lag time before he was appointed. He came on board with Board of Water and Light on November 15th. He has held one meeting already with regional first responders on the 2nd of December. Certainly, they already know him. They know his abilities. And I think that he is going to take to heart all the recommendations that we made and come up with a comprehensive emergency operations plan for the Board of Water and Light. One of our strongest criticisms was the lack of preparedness by the Board of Water and Light for an event of this sort. You always have to anticipate events that you have not yet seen, even though it's difficult to do so, and have a preparedness plan that sort of encompasses the entire organization, and they did not do so. I know that he's already working on that plan. I've met personally with him on a couple of occasions to give him sort of, you know, volunteer advice, if you will, on things to include in that plan. So I know that they will have a new comprehensive plan in place pretty soon. You then have to change the corporate culture. You then have to have a sense of preparedness throughout the entire organization. You have to have command and control right from the very top so that you've got to have that comprehensive plan, not just created, but it has to be embraced by the entire organization, and it has to be exercised, and it then has to be integrated with the regional plans for the many different municipalities and cities that have their citizens who are customers of Board of Water and Light.
And with that in mind, the corporate culture, do you believe that based on everything that happened, the embarrassment of a year ago, and then the recommendations that the community review team put out, do you believe Lansing Board of Water and Light's better prepared going into this winter?
Yeah, I do believe they're better prepared. I think it takes a while to change corporate culture. You know, you can't change direction of the aircraft carrier quickly. It takes quite a while to change the corporate culture, and it takes a while to restore public trust in the organization. But I think as they continue doing the things that they are doing and continue to prepare and continue to have transparent communications with their customers, I think that they can restore that trust. But as you point out, I think, or implicitly point out, Cynthia, I think that the real test will be the next event that we have, whether it's this winter or some other event.
Michael McDaniel is professor at Western Michigan University's Cooley Law School in Lansing and a retired brigadier general. He was part of the community review team that analyzed just what went wrong during that ice storm a year ago that knocked out power to some 40,000 customers of Lansing Board of Water and Light. Good talking with you, Michael. Thank you so much.
My pleasure entirely. Thank you.
This is Julia Child. Bon appetit. Love
that. Delicious. There's a fairly widely held and deep-rooted narrative about food and kids, specifically children in France and children here in the USA. The French diet is held up as superior, while U.S. kids are viewed as hooked on fries, pizza, burgers, and soft drinks. But should all of that be tossed aside? Chris Cook is here. He is the chief wine and restaurant critic for Our Detroit magazine. Chris, take us across the Atlantic, first of all. What's happening with French kids and what they're eating?
Well, there's a lot that's changed in the French diet generally, but it's translated down into what people are eating at home. And I think that they're experiencing a great deal of what we experienced for a long time, which is a lot of extra hours working and trying to keep bread on the table and doing all that kind of thing, and less time with the old traditional growing up. So for The French kids, I have a nephew and a niece who are French. They're born there, and they eat perfectly well. They're sort of split between the old French diet of, the foie gras and all that kind of thing, even as kids. But they're also into the pizza and Coke and the hamburgers.
The Americanization of the French diet.
In fact, my nephew, who speaks no English, came here about a year ago, and he wanted to go to Hard Rock Cafe, and he ate the most disgusting burger you've ever seen. I mean, you know, it's a French kid. I'm saying, where are your jeans?
You know, it's funny because we have a family friend who is over here at the U of M Law School, and I took him to the grocery store, and as I noticed, he was stocking up on those frozen pizzas and making sure he had a good stash of pizzas there. Well, then what's happening on this side of the Atlantic? If they're going more Americanized, are our kids becoming more savvy?
I think so, and I think it's the parents that are influencing this. I mean, we in the United States have become a far more food-conscious culture. We now view food not simply as resuscitation, but it's something to nourish the soul and that kind of thing. And I think that the introduction of food in the home and more the cooking shows that come on TV and all that kind of influence has really sort of embedded in the American home and created a much more sophisticated food culture. We're aware of different types of food much more than we ever used to be. And as the United States of America, we have all kinds of different food coming at us from immigrant cultures and our past all the time. And we are able to distinguish a lot more. And so in many ways, I think Americans are becoming far more open-minded because of that, because they get so many things. Right now, the big influence, of course, is coming from Latin America, is coming our way, and from Asia. And those are the two big areas that have sort of merged into American culture. Well, I mean, if you grow up with all this, you are aware of a lot more. You don't see a lot of things other than Italian food in France.
You're right.
You really don't.
Or Germany. You're right.
Chinese is a novelty,
mm-hmm.
and Vietnamese because of the French connection there, but it's all very small. And then after that, you're into French regional food, which is marvelous too. But it's not the consciousness of there being other types of food is not as prevalent in France. And I think that once things like pizza, Coke, and hamburgers make their way in there, you know, it's easy to do.
The barbarian is at the gate. Some may feel, because I think some of that is because the French have always been pretty self-satisfied with their cuisine and the way they have things and weren't particularly interested in breaking down barriers.
For very good reasons.
Yeah.
I mean, they were on top of it, and the Italians were too in a different way. But now we're developing this American food culture, and it is very different. And a lot of it has got things like barbecue, I mean, smoked meats, mm-hmm. things like that, are very central to our culture and not so much in the French vernacular.
Chris Cook, Chief Wine and Restaurant Critic for Our Detroit. As always, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Now, let's get a little funky. Stateside's Emily Fox has this profile of the Third Coast Kings.
Well, I was cruising in my slick ride, my sweet baby by my side. From the city to the country, that's when I hear sirens and I see lights. Well, the cops stopped me in my love boat, it won't 50 now and I give him a C note. I'm coming back the way I came, you can drive fast and a damn sure ring broke.
This is Sean Ike. He's the frontman of the Ann Arbor-based band The Third Coast Kings. When he is on stage, he commands your attention. He's usually wearing brightly colored suits or sparkly suits, and he's usually dancing or jumping around the mic, sometimes with a tambourine. He's tapping all over his body. And in the few seconds he might have free, he's usually wiping the sweat off of his shaved head with a hand towel he has nearby.
If you give us 5 or 6 songs, if you're not at least tapping your foot, they should check your pulse or we're doing it wrong.
Ike is the only black member of the 7-piece funk and soul band.
As a sole black man in front of a mostly white band playing in front of a lot of mostly white folks in the Michigan area, Yes, I feel that, you know, I have a responsibility to make sure I look good, sound good, perform well. You know, don't come off like I'm what they call half-stepping.
Ike also says no matter what the racial makeup is of the band, that sense of responsibility also means making sure he represents the music well.
I see that as a responsibility to carry on that social, physical, emotional, and spiritual function that funk and funky music has and that they talk about in the songs. James Brown talks about, you know, not only get on the good foot and Papa has a brand new bag, but get up, get into it, and get involved.
And you can also hear that kind of message in Third Coast Kings tunes like in Get Some, Leave Some.
If you wanna get some, you better leave some. If you wanna get some, you better leave some. Don't be so stingy that you hurt yourself. Trying to hoard what's good from everybody else. Hey, if you wanna get some, you better leave some.
And that kind of music is resonating across the globe. Turns out the Third Coast Kings are kind of a big deal in Japan. While the band has been playing in Michigan for about 7 years, it wasn't until 2012 that they realized they also had a following in Japan. That's the year they got invited to the Fuji Rock Festival.
The Fuji Rock Festival is kind of like Coachella or Lollapalooza in the mountains of Japan. And 150,000 people over 3 days.
And a lot of people came to see them play.
When I raised my hands to do the, hey, everybody clap, or hey, everybody wave your hands in the air, that thing, and you see 10 to 15,000 hands go up and follow your command. That's a dream I did not know that I had.
And it wasn't just people in the audience that loved the Third Coast Kings. When Ike and the band went to Tower Records in Tokyo, they saw their record on the top shelf of the store.
And there was a banner above it saying, no funk, no life. So I point to the CD and I point to myself and say, this is my band, Third Coast Kings, that I'm in. And then the gentleman gives me a puzzled look, and then he points at me and goes, oh. He goes to get his friend, and his friend is a big, big Third Coast Kings fan. Then autographs, photographs. The other members of the band show up, and then it becomes this a little bit of a thing.
If you get this excited about the Third Coast Kings or want to check them out for the first time, they'll be headlining a New Year's Eve show at Cliff Bells in Detroit on the 31st. For Stateside, I'm Emily Fox.
Stateside's executive producer is Zoe Clark. Stateside is engineered by Bob Scon. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.